I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Poem Talk has once again gone on the road to Bolinas, California, on a little sea-surrounded peninsula just north of San Francisco. I'm joined here in Bolinas at the lovely home of Stephen Radcliffe by Lily Applebaum, Chris Martin, and Zach Cardner, who traveled west with me, and also by our three Poem Talkers today, by Julia Block, who has also traveled west from Philly to her old Northern California stomping grounds. And today I found out that really was stomping grounds because you've done a lot of hiking around here, where she's been giving readings. The poet, teacher, scholar, editor, whose recent books include Valley Fever 2015, a more recent chapbook called Hollywood Fever. No, it's not Hollywood,
Hollywood
Fever.
Hollywood Forever.
Hollywood Forever. Too many fevers there. And the 2013 Letters to Kelly Clarkson, which was a finalist for the 2013 Lambda Literary Award, whose scholarly and critical interests include formal hybridity, the post-war long poem, and gender and ideology and the place of the lyric, and who I'm thrilled to say is the director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Pennsylvania and former student of the aforementioned poet and host of our gathering today, Stephen Radcliffe, publisher of Avenue B Press, longtime director of the Creative Writing Program at Mills College, where he worked with Julia some years ago, who is Boston-born but has lived here in Bolinas since 1973, author of 20-plus books of poems, including Ideas, Mirror, Distance, Sculpture, and Spaces in the Light, said to be where one comes from, whose recent triptych trilogy consists of three books and maybe more, 1,000 pages and 1,000 days in duration, and let's make that 5 such books. Talk about duration. And whose main concern these days has been how experience in the three-dimensional world can be translated, transcribed to the two-dimensional page, and whose mesmerizing repetitive Instagrams, mostly of Bolinas seascapes, I not only follow closely, but long for daily. And finally, I'm thrilled to say we're also joined here by Joanne Kiger, whose On Time Poems 2005-2014 was published by City Lights in 2015, among whose many, many other books are As Ever, a book of selected poems published in 2002, Just Space, which gathers poems written between 1979 and 1989, and a book I'm currently obsessed with, Joanne, with Strange Big Moon, the Japan and Indian Journals, 1960 to 64, whose roots poetically and personally and spiritually are here in the Bay Area and indeed here in Bolinas, whose poems often show a mindfulness of daily events and the Northern California landscape and often use form and shape as outgrowths of subject matter. Steve, thank you so much for hosting us here at your house.
My pleasure.
It's great to see you again.
Thank
you. And Joanne, thanks for walking down the lane.
Thank you.
To be here with us. We're so happy to visit you both here in Bolinas. And Julia, how does it feel to be back in your old, what did I say, stomping grounds?
Yeah, it feels like I never left. The air is familiar. The smells are familiar. It's lovely.
Those of us sitting on this side of the table, Joanne and I, we should describe what the view is from
the white horse.
There's a white horse galloping across, and there's only one house visible. There's only one house visible, and
it's mythic. A white horse, riderless.
That's a good omen, I think. A riderless white horse.
And
before
the Tamalpais Ridge.
Yeah, and the drought, which is obviously the bane of everyone's existence here, has created amazing colors.
This is what it's usually like in the summer. This
drought or no drought, yeah.
Bumblebees in the lavender.
Oh, it's great. Can we do a thousand pages of Poem Talk today and just be here forever into the night?
That would be nice.
That would be nice. I'm afraid we might do injustice to Whalen's poem if we talk about it for 1,000 hours. Well, we are here today to talk about a poem by Philip Whalen, also, of course, a poet who spent important moments of his life and work here in Bolinas. Our poem was indeed written in Bolinas in 1968 and finished in Kyoto, Japan in 1969. It's called Life at Bolinas, The Last of California, and can be found on pages 655 through 657 in the collected poems. Philip Whalen's Penn Sound page includes a recording of his performance of this poem, the last poem he read at an event in Albuquerque in 1987. So here now is Philip Whalen performing Life at Bolinas.
Life at Bolinas, The Last of California, for Margot and John Doss. The things that are down should be up. The things that are up should be down. Confusion, mess, and itchiness. Rearrange. I have to rearrange the world. Make a demand. Gold rises. Crudel. What goes here? Force majeure. The world being oblong with chrysanthemums. Explosion of shape, charge, instant paisley steel plate tattoo. Curiously, they went under the waves, undulation, unhesitatingly, no thought of strength or where they could, straight ahead. Yum. Straight out of the basket, that stuff is gray matter with everything already there. Three brains? Yes, out through the screams of laughing, drums, flutes, right and left-hand music, voices and hand-clapping, whoop! Brilliance leaks out the cracks around the stony door, out through the gong clang, whoop! They got the sun by the wrist, yarded her out of the cave, while the girl who did the naughty dance covers herself calmly. Oh, ask what you want. Book, cough, uncivilized stove insurance in the living room. Sit down, put in your order and be patient. Total failure of civilization? Bong, whoop, clap, wiggle, blink, squash flower, chrysanthemum puzzle. Long past midnight, quiet house, purple green-eared smiling bat, call on myself, demand one word more. A new start, great inky swashes arranged, a painting, a new life, wet, dry, across the world, oh-ho! Every time a distinct shape mark. Who cares how long it takes? Desire. Candy hand. Toothsome obscurities. Candy hand. Sugar baby. Who knows why kind of fun. At Duxbury Point, a few thousand feet from here, the wind blows heavy, 35 miles per hour all night long. Big lights at the post office illuminate Brighton Avenue. The raccoons can see to get across. As I pass through the dark dining room, I perceive that each chair is occupied by dwarf ghoul corpse, yammering, decomposing, power. Blithering dead leaves along the ground, crooked sunlight, falling smoke, black wind. Electric power failure woke me up. I broke the kitchen clock. Franco and Judy, hungry in Zurich.
Well, I know we're going to be able to go everywhere and anywhere, because there's so much here, but can we start by just contemplating the use of the word last in the subtitle? Does it make sense to you? Is it last in the sense of the furthest end of the continent, or is it last because it's a survival? What do you make of that?
That's a question, Al. And the other word I would look at in the title that is connected to that is the word right above it, the second word in the first line of the title, at, which has a short A sound also, and a T. But life in Bolinas is not the same as life at Bolinas, but also last. It could be a farewell to California, but I don't think it was. I don't know if he wrote this near the end of his Bolinas stay. He went to Kyoto not long after he wrote it.
His first stint in Bolinas is November 67, so he's been here a while when he starts the poem. Joanne, does last make sense to you? The last of California?
I mean, like an end of an era.
Yes,
for
that's
him.
What I was thinking.
I mean, this is his second trip to Japan. He first goes in, what, 1968? The at certainly draws your attention to the preposition, it has that awkward little sense.
To the two of you who've spent many years here in Bolinas, I direct this question. I mean, do you recognize the Bolinas Wayland's Bolinas that you know in this poem? Are there bits and pieces of, can you point out a few of those?
Well, things? This, you know, essentially his Bolinas days goes from 68 to 71. And at that point, Bolinas was a fairly empty town. It hadn't been really, quote, discovered. That when I came here in 68, there was 500 people living here. And it was mostly, it was the excitement was from the high school surfers that had come out and discovered Bolinas and came out, you know, and started surfing out here. Otherwise, it was, there was no, very little development on the Mesa. The downtown had these houses that had somehow continued from the turn of the last century. And the Doss house, that where Phillips stayed, was an old house too, sea captain.
All those houses kind of on
a
Brighton.
Better built.
And he dedicates the poem to them.
To John and Margot Doss.
Right. And Margot was a feature writer at San Francisco Chronicle, and he was a doctor, and they had a second house.
And a poet.
Margot was, when I was a kid growing up and reading the Chronicle, you know, Margot Doss had a column called The Bay Area at Your Feet, and she went on walks all of the time.
Yeah.
She was probably writing about, you know, this part of California.
Julie, you were out here long enough to have a sense of Bolinas as a place that was, that people felt was not simply insular by way of the geography, but also insular by way of people wanting it to not be overrun. This poem could be thought of as fairly insular in its references. You sort of have to know Bolinas to get it. But I don't know Bolinas except for this visit today, and it seems to me that I'm getting a feel for it. Does one get a feel for this if you're not familiar with the scene, Julia?
Well, I read the poem in Philadelphia, not in Bolinas. And so I had the experience of reading the poem very far away and not being in this place and not having my memories kind of well up until we arrived here before this recording. What really struck me about the poem is how much it's a poem about writing a poem. Like, you know, in the beginning, we get the things that are down should be up, the things that are up should be down. That could be about this place. That could be about a kind of topsy-turviness of a new place or a place that you visit and go away and come back to. But it seems to me that there's also a lot in the poem, beginning with those two lines, about observation in general and about kind of using the poem to capture, you know, kind of a moving experience. Moving, I mean, as in I'm thinking about like the way the sea moves and the way the poem itself is referring to the way the water is moving.
Hmm. Can we, Joanne, try to make sense of the up and down at the beginning? I wrote, you know, the things that are down should be up. That suggests a big change, an apocalypse, a revolution of some kind. And then there's the reference to itchiness, which I just took to be restlessness.
Well, this could be written in Kyoto. This is his second trip, so he's not having a big culture flash. But the fact that you're sitting on the floor and you have your shelves around, you don't have the same kind of ease of getting in and out of a place.
I like that sense that, you know, in the dateline at the end, it says, you know, ends in Kyoto, but he wrote...
Maybe he wrote that there
at the beginning of, say, I'm going to pull this poem out and work on it and finish it now. And so something that was written in Kyoto.
I don't know when he decided to write this, but I think these were written in bits and pieces in his notebook. And when he decided to pull it together,
right,
he had some, you know, inner composition that, you know, that worked for him. Someone told me how he would lay his papers out on the floor, you know, and he wrote, remember, he wrote everything by hand. His original manuscript, so he could take out, you know, sections, like he was scoring some kind of composition.
Mm-hmm. It's very notebooky, and all because it seems to be a collage of scenes, but it's also, as you say, constantly referring. And Julia suggested this constantly referring to the writing of this poem. I'm thinking of a section right in the middle: "Quiet house, purple green eared, smiling, but." Call on myself, demand one word more.
Oh, yeah.
Suggests that he needs to write. And then you get this almost calligraphic, painterly writing, a new start, great inky swashes, arranged, a painting, a new life. I was just riffing when I saw that, and I thought, okay, he's come to Bolinas. He's trying to write. He's found a place where he wants to write, a quiet house that gets referred to at the end again. And he seems to be taking the Kyoto, his interest in calligraphy and in writing, seriously as a command to himself to write. Julie, you're nodding. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I circled desire, and he prints desire with an exclamation point. Right. And so every time a distinct shape mark, who cares how long it takes? Who cares how long it is past midnight or, you know, what, all the things that might distract me from this moment, but the desire to write and the desire to take things down into the notebook is what's holding the poem together and helps it come through.
You know, I think one of the little inserted sections that's right on the first page in italics, the curiously they went under the waves, undulation, unhesitatingly, no thought of strength or whether they could straight ahead.
Is that drowning?
I think it's surfing.
Joanne, I thought it was
mentioned, I think, you know, you said really nicely, one of the big excitements, or maybe the only big excitement, was all the high school kids who discovered surfing.
Right. So he's observing.
Curiously, they went under the waves, undulation, unhesitatingly, no thought of strength or where they could, straight ahead. Yum. Straight out of the basket, that stuff is gray matter with everything already there. Three brains? Yes, out through the screams of laughing, drums, flutes, right and left-hand music, voices and hand-clapping. Whoop! Brilliance leaks out the cracks around the stony door, out through the gong clang. Whoop!
We seem to have three italicized, indented sections in which some kind of music-making, wildness, maybe partying, is going on. Does anybody make sense of that?
Back in the 70s, when I moved here in 73, there was something called the Sun Festival.
Oh, right.
And it was always in, like, May Day or something, and it was the blessing of the babies, and the pilgrims would gather on the sewer ponds and dance. But
drums, flutes, I mean, I think this is Japanese music, you know, like Shinto shrine or temple music, you know, it's going on all the time. He's also got the gong clang whoop.
Yeah. Right. Tell us about the Amaterasu.
Amaterasu. They caught the sun by the wrist, yarded her out of her cave. That's Amaterasu, the sun god, from 3,000 years ago, who was all the emperors are descended from. And she got into some kind of fight with her brother and went into this cave, and there was no sun. So they tried to think of all these things to bring her out. They hung a mirror by the door, and then they had some girl go do a striptease, and finally she stuck her head out the door. And
Joanne did some really good research here.
And there it is in the poem.
In the poem. I thought it was Bolinas, but I think...
You waited this long to spring it on us.
So anyway, they get her to come out. They grab her, and she brings back the sun. And it's, you know, it's their creation myth.
I love that because...
Can we connect the creation myth that he's drawing from the Kyoto thinking and experience to this going to Bolinas to write more creation myth, one word more, trying to get himself to create?
No.
Okay, good. So what is the connection between Kyoto and
Bolinas? Well, I think you could...
Well, I think he wrote that when he was in Kyoto.
You know? But I
mostly
think...
Mostly he writes these in two different places.
This is 11 months of writing. I think that the line about the girl who did the naughty dance covers herself calmly. That's really so kind of graphic, descriptive. Maybe there was nothing like that happening in Bolinas in the 60s. I doubt it. I think that those things were happening in the 70s in Bolinas.
Well, certainly the closing of the poem, which takes us back to Bolinas, it's night, the wind is howling, power's out, kitchen clock ticking.
He's back in Bolinas, yeah.
Yeah. And that's a beautiful ending where he's saying, well, here's where I am, blithering dead leaves.
So curiously, he ends in Zurich.
Well, he's Franco and Judy, are his friends from the first trip.
Right.
Yeah.
That he met, Franco Beltrametti.
And, met them in Kyoto or in Bolinas?
Yeah.
Okay.
In fact, Franco learned English from Philip.
Oh.
And then they went back to Zurich.
So he's thinking of them there.
Yeah, he probably got a letter from
them.
Yeah,
of course. Mm. Got a letter.
Saying, we're hungry in Zurich.
that's a beautiful sense, though, of how
and
the
poem moves.
He
did break the kitchen clock, because I remember him being
around.
Worried about that.
You've annotated that, too. He broke the kitchen clock.
Do you know how he broke it?
He did something or other. He went into the kitchen. He was the only person that was staying at the Doss house. They had a big house built for a lot of people to feed. And so he was, at that one point, he goes around and has a vision of the dining room, dark dining room. Each chair is occupied by a dwarf ghoul corpse. That was a vision he had, too. I mean, I don't know what substances he was taking, but...
You know, the ending of the poem, I think, is really a great instance of how the whole poem is put together and how it works, because it moves around so much. I mean, you know, from the title, Life at Bolinas, to Zurich at the end, to Kyoto. And the details, I think, are, you know, located in Bolinas, except for the letter comes there, if it's not mentioned. But everything, I'm just looking here, everything in those last four lines, there's something... amiss. There's the dead leaves, there's the crooked sun, that beautiful line, crooked sunlight, falling smoke, black wind. Then the electric power is failing. I broke the clock. They're hungry. It's kind of bleak.
It's a storm.
It's such
time.
A weird combination. How does a power failure wake you up? Because presumably when there's a power failure, everything goes quiet.
Oh, well, it could
and
be.
Everything goes
it's
dark.
It's so quiet.
It's probably howling wind.
Yeah, the quiet, like the startling of that change, I guess, wakes you up. And then I broke the kitchen clock, which comes right after that part of the line. So all these details also are just jammed together as if they were a string, as if they were telling one story, but they are actually so disparate.
I really like the raccoon.
Yeah.
It's just, you know.
Yeah.
It like reminds me of
totally real.
The skunk in Lowell's Skunk Hour. There's a, you know.
Yeah.
It's almost off season and this raccoons are taking over.
Big music party going over two blocks away.
Yeah, this is perfect.
This is the flutes.
There's
the flutes and the gongs leaking out under the cracks of the stony door.
Bong, whoop, clap, wiggle.
I'm also interested and would love to hear you folks on this in the almost, dare I say it, Poundian historical collage moment of how he gets to the line, total failure of civilization. It's a big claim.
Yeah,
I think he makes it a lot, though, doesn't he? Civilization
does
is always failing him.
And it's a question mark, and he reads it that way. But it's preceded with cough, uncivilized. So there's the connection to civilization. Cough, uncivilized stove insurance in the living room. Sit down, put in your order, and be patient. And then, total failure of civilization. Anybody want to make some sense of that? It's a great line. It's certainly.
It's a great line. Yeah.
Well, it comes right after ask for what you want, book. And I love the way he reads that in the poem.
Yeah.
It really is if he's conjuring, like, I want a book. So is put in your order also about asking for what you want? So you can ask for what you want. You can also put in your order, but you have to be patient. And then, so I don't know if it's like, oh, you say you want a total failure of civilization. You say you want to be in this remote, idyllic spot where... You know, all of these things can't touch us. Like we can be beyond. We can be at the last edge.
Nice, book. Ask for what you want. This is the time of On Boar's Head, Harcourt Brace world. Big moment for him, right? Or it's just after, I guess. Joanne, he was. My understanding could be wrong. Is that he came to Bolinas first, as Harcourt Brace in New York was finishing up. This typesetting and so forth.
Hmm. This was written during his first trip to Bolinas, right?
Yeah, the first trip starts in November of 67, and here he is in writing, starting
then
to
his
write
this. Second trip, he comes back, which was in March of 69 to June of 71, to look at the proofs from Harcourt Brace.
Okay, so this precedes that.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But book. I mean, I'm trying to read the...
Well, the books are so important to him. I mean, it's like candy. I mean, there is an important
get
book.
Candy,
let's
candy
say
hand.
Candy hand.
Let's
sugar
say
babies.
It really clearly so you understand his book. You know, it's fulfillment.
When I mentioned that I would like us to talk about this poem today, all three of you separately reacted, not to say it's a bad poem, but to think, what an odd choice. Can we say, for people who might be listening to us and not, you know, not very familiar with Whalen's work as a whole, can we say how this work is different from what you might encounter elsewhere, and also maybe how it gives you a sense of his process? How is it different, and how is it the same? Or why did you think this was an odd choice, other than that it's about Bellinas partly? Steve?
Well, I think looking at the poem, you know, first of all, listening to him reading,
it's great reading, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great reading. It all goes right by you, right? I mean, because it's not a narrative. It has a locational kind of title, but it ends in Zurich and it moves everywhere in between, you know.
Yeah.
It's hard to get your bearings in this poem because it keeps leaping. Okay. But I think when you sit down and do a close reading, what we're doing, when we're starting to look at it, all the parts seem to fit together in a way that's very interesting.
And you have a greater sense of that now that we've been talking about it.
Yeah, I do, because it wasn't a poem I knew.
Yeah.
You know, I'd never read it before.
Why do you think, and I want to hear Julia and Joanne on this, but Steve, why do you think in Albuquerque this was his encore poem? Was that just an accident, or does it mean something?
I doubt it. I think he must have loved this poem.
Yeah, why?
I don't know. It does something. Mm. I mean, it actually puts, it probably, I can only guess, but I could imagine that this poem puts its finger on something about his experience here, plus Kyoto. Some of it was written there. And that it meant something to him in some personal way.
Yeah.
You know, it's like an homage to place and also to this, you know, there's a whole interior world going on inside of this poem that we're guessing at and he knows about.
Julie, can you try the same question? But I don't know how deep your familiarity with Whalen is, but how do you think this poem fits?
Yeah, I mean, it's what really struck me with the poem was what's going on the page. And in this poem, when I first looked at it, the force majeure really jumped out at me. And so I've always, since I started looking at the poem, I thought about what's unforeseen and how the unforeseen keeps coming into the poem, and then the poem pulls back to the concrete detail. So there are all these constant interruptions, and it's tempting to just read that in the language of the family of images that populate this poem, like the sea and surfing and things, objects, people bobbing in and out of the waves. But it's obviously more than that, too. It's what Joanne just said about how important the book was. The book is never just a bunch of, you know, pieces of paper with ink printed on them. It's about making the world or rearranging the world and remaking it almost in a Mallarmean sense.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Joanne, what are your thoughts about this poem in relation to Whalen's usual work? Is it unusual?
No, I don't think it's unusual. There was a remark that Dick Baker, his later teacher at the Zen Center, said that Philip Whalen treated words as solid objects and juxtaposed them creatively. So I think you can see how he uses the words. I mean, they're musical, he's scoring the page, but they're also building blocks of somewhere, how he puts them, constructs them in the space he has. He wrote everything by hand, so he's very aware of the relationship of the word and the page and the space around it, and uses that, you know, to score his voice, or the timing of the page, how long it takes to get to the next word, whether it's in caps or not.
Did he type these poems after the notebook?
I think the final step was to type it up.
Yeah.
I don't think he ever composed on the typewriter.
Right.
I should have checked this. Did this poem appear in On Boar's Head, which would have been the next book? Does anybody know? On Bear's Head, sorry.
I looked, you know, it's curious.
And it wasn't in there. It's in the collected, of course.
It's not in there, but...
So he left it out.
But in the table of contents, it
seems fits
as
right
though
in
it
there.
Should be in there, but it's not.
Yeah.
I don't know if he edited On Bear's Head. I think that Jim Kohler and what's his name, worked on the editing. And then he came back and worked on it. And, of course, the book that Philip... Michael Rothenberg edited. He probably just went through Philip's work and put in what he
right.
thought should be included, which right. means that he saved it in some kind
but
of
But it's not in on Bear's head.
Can we go around, and this is meant really for Steve and Joanne in particular, and give you a chance to recollect Philip Whalen in Bolinas, something that's can be recorded and preserved, some encounter, some or just a general sense of what he was like here. He came, as I understand it, first to get away from San Francisco to find a quiet place. Joanne reminded me he didn't have a car, so he would have to get up here and he would stay. And I guess he wrote, he wandered around town. What do you remember? You've been here since 73, so you saw him in later when he wasn't really doing any
I have,
stints.
I never saw him in Bolinas.
Yeah.
And I knew Don Allen when I met here. When I came here, I knew of him, but I didn't meet him until he moved away. And he said to me when I, at one point, I put this in a poem so I remember it. I read it in the Bill Berkson memorial the other day. It's strange we never met in what Bill Berkson calls Celesteville. So, but I don't have, I'm sure Joanne is the person to really put your question to.
Joanne, what do you want to say about Philip Whalen in Bolinas? What was it like?
I think he came out here because Margot had a place and invited him, and he was always looking for a patron, which is finally why his eventual 30-some years at the Zen Center worked so well. He was taken care of. He had a place to sleep. There was food that was there, and he could focus his studies or his meditation. He was out here. She came out in January of 72 and invited Philip to come and live at the Zen Center. And bypassing all these other kind of, you know, other people that had signed up and filled out their forms, yeah. he said, come and stay, and you don't have to do anything. Just come and stay here. And Philip at that point had been petitioning the University of California, I'll do anything you want, just let me stay there and have an organ to play and just feed me. You know, he was not willing to step into the 9-to-5 world. Mm. So his time in Bolinas went from the, late 60s to the, to say 71. So it wasn't a long time. And at that point, Bolinas was just trying to figure out where it was going. It was in 71, they declared a water moratorium, and it became very political at that point because that meant that they couldn't build any more houses. So and there was a lot of young people here, Harvard graduates that somehow, Orville Schell, and a lot of people who took over the water department and started to be part of the political structure, such as it was, that held the town together, which is the water board. So he wasn't part of that.
Right, right, exactly.
His social scene was with poets, and when he shared this place with Joe Brainard, I think he saw a lot of people. That was very nice, but he decided it was too many people after a while.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot going on in this poem, and we all prepared all kinds of things to say, but why don't we go around one more time and allow each other to add one final thought about the poem or about Whalen and Bolinas that we didn't get a chance to say. So, Steve, we'll start with you. One last thought.
Yeah. I'm really interested in the last four lines. Again, the blithering dead leaves along the ground, crooked sunlight falling, smoke, black wind, electric power failure woke me up. I broke the kitchen clock. Frank Hill and Judy hungry in Zurich. He calls it Zurich. I think there's passages in this poem that are revealing in some sense of the interior world of Philip Whalen. And he doesn't ever say what they are. He presents them in kind of Poundian, an image, you know, or events or actions. But there's a lot of heartfelt something in this poem that's below the surface. There's a kind of bleakness at the end of this poem that maybe resonates. I don't know. It's kind of doing a psychological, you know.
Yeah, but the also, they're so concrete. Poundian. It's also Ginsbergian briefly. Crooked sunlight falling, smoke, black wind. You get the accumulation at the end of the monosyllables and then the use of
And it's words as objects being stacked together.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like one word in these lines. It's a very beautiful passage.
That's a strong line.
Yeah.
Julia, final thought?
I really love these three lines, the world being oblong with chrysanthemums.
Yeah.
And the chrysanthemums come back later in the poem, too.
What did you think oblong meant?
Well, I read it at first literally, like a chrysanthemum is kind of an oblong oval shape, but you're shaking your head now.
No,
I've got it totally wrong.
Round.
Totally round.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a leap then. It's actually quite a strange image if you're mm-hmm. describing a chrysanthemum as oblong and not totally round.
Right.
And there was something about those three lines that I couldn't help but think of a poem like H.D.'s Oread and seeing the pines in the sea.
Oh, yeah.
And I think I see the world in the Wayland poem, in this part of the Wayland poem, as also possibly referring to the sea, because then we get the sea a little further down on the page. So again, just echoing what has been said about words as objects being stacked on top of each other, and then the shapes of objects becoming the shape of the world is really striking to me there.
Joanne, your final thought on any of this?
I love the point where he just locates himself on Duxbury Point, because I thought, well, at last I know where he is.
Yeah.
Duxbury Point is over there. It's the longest shale reef on the coast.
So here would be a few thousand feet from there. What would here be the house?
Here would be where he is living down at the house, Doss House downtown. And downtown was comparatively empty in those days.
Yeah.
There was very little action going on.
Mm.
And the wind blowing 35 miles an hour, and if you can look across the street and see the post office and see the raccoon going across the street, it just gives a sense of
very real,
you know, quiet, empty place that was Bolinas in those days and then.
It's curious to me that he says ducks.
Duxbury.
Oh, yeah, he doesn't spell it right.
That's not the way we locals...
You say Duxbury?
Duxbury.
He's Duxbury. A bit of an outsider.
But how do you actually spell it? How do you actually spell it?
He spelled it correctly.
Oh, you spell it right.
But he pronounced it in the reading as if he were an outsider.
Duxbury.
Yeah.
Yeah, as if it... Yeah, yeah. I think that sense of... I mean, it was just, as you say, a few years that he was here, and he didn't really mix in the town's politics or... So maybe this confusion, mess, and itchiness is coming back to Bolinas. I don't know the days. I don't know.
My final thought follows from your comment, Steve, about the pronunciation of Duxbury like an outsider. Even though it says Life at Bolinas, and it's beautifully dedicated to patrons.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, in
that's
a way...
so classic.
In a way, a poem you would think would be written years later when you look back on Life at Bolinas and those people who were nice to me. But it's contemporaneous with the generosity of these two people.
Yeah, patrons.
But
it's great.
I think, you know, Life at Bolinas, the last of California, and yet it's not a Bolinas poem, it's a world poem, as we've all pointed out. We've got the reference to friends in Zurich and, of course, to Kyoto and then the whole question of the future of civilization, not just of Bolinas.
And the cosmos.
I wouldn't call it a tension. I would call it like an inclusion of Life at Bolinas, the last of whatever this is, kind of a farewell maybe, and all this other stuff going on that comes from elsewhere. And my favorite moment is what goes here, it's all caps, in the middle of... some writing on the left and some writing on the right, as if to say that one word more, which he's struggling later in the poem to produce, that might go there sometime. Well,
that's nice.
It's almost if you lived here, you'd be here by, you'd if be you home knew, by now.
If you could
moment.
Pronounce Duxbury properly, maybe you would know what word would go there.
Mm-hmm. And it's the writing, it's the poem about writing.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't it great? I mean, we have... to people who really know this town. And isn't it great that a visitor or someone who didn't spend that much time here and who can't pronounce the thing right does, as Joanne says, just so movingly in the third to last and the last stanza really describe, and also in the surfer passage, really describe what he sees as if he really does want to get this place. Well, we like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, which is a chance for all of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. So who would like to gather some paradise and make a recommendation? Julia?
I would like to make a recommendation for Susan Lander's book, Frankenstein, which is another... She's another great poet who thinks a lot about place, and she's written a book-length poem about the Germantown neighborhood of Philadelphia, and it began as a mashup of Benjamin Franklin's autobiography and two texts by Gertrude Stein, and then it became, if you can believe it, much more than that, and it's a very heterogeneous, documentary, lyric, visual kind of book, and it's completely gorgeous, and I can't get enough of it.
That's fantastic. Thank you. And the project is Frankenstein.
Frankenstein, and it came out from Roof Books.
Oh, boy. Fantastic. I think I saw that announced.
Steve, you have a recommendation?
You know, I'm going to have to be retrograde here. I'm just That's thinking okay. about what I've been reading. And I want to go back in history to Edmund Spenser, but it's connected to this poem. Last week in the class, we were talking about one of Spenser's sonnets, the Amoretti. I think it was number 76, maybe. And it begins, one day I wrote her name upon the strand, but came the waves and washed it away, or washed it away, as the helpful Norton put in an accent over the ED. So, you know, trying to write on the sand, and the wave comes and washes it away. Again, I wrote it with a second hand, and came the tide and made my pains its prey, or something like that. So
Spenser has never been shouted out or gathered as paradise yet,
you know,
in Poem Talk.
Spenser's a poet whom one could read with interest, actually. I never knew that either until last year when I started to look at those poems in a little survey class.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Great recommendation. Joanne, your Gathering Paradise?
Comes to mind a recent book by the young, well, he's not so young anymore, poet Cedar Saigo, who's from Washington State. He has a very elegant rhetoric mixed with Bob Creeley's ear and John Wiener's flow. As I said, he's a Native American from Washington State, Suquamish tribe, but that doesn't predominate in his work. His newest book is coming out from Wave Press called Royals, and I always find him full of a beautiful density of an appreciation of language.
Fantastic. My Gathering Paradise, which has been swirling around in my head because I've been sitting here looking across at the two of you, Steve and Julia, and the backyard. Do you call this a backyard? I want to... How can I gather paradise and mention a book of poems or a poet when I'm staring at paradise? May this always be exactly the way is now.
Yeah.
And if any people who have any plans to develop bulimia are hearing
Please.
This Poem Talk, chances are slim that they are.
That.
Then please
call you up.
Call me up or do whatever you have to keep this thing going exactly the way it is. Well, that's all the total failure of civilization we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing, the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania, and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks so much to my guests, Steve Ratcliffe, Julia Block, and Joanne Kiger, and Stephen once again for hosting us at his house here. And to Poem Talk's directors and engineers today, Zach Cardner, Chris Martin, and Lily Applebaum, and to Poem Talk's editor, the self-same amazing Zach Cardner. Next time on Poem Talk, back in Philadelphia, Rachel Zoff, Ron Silliman, and Charles Bernstein will join me in talking about two poems by the now 98-year-old poet Naomi Raplansky. someone who met Gertrude Stein in person in 1934.
Wow.
Now 98. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us for that for another episode of Poem Talk.